Today is Friday the 13th. Welcome to session 5106. Happy 70th birthday, India, making the world's largest democracy work. I'm your moderator. My name is Nikhil Mankekar. I'm a human rights activist in the city of Boulder, and I was also assigned this panel because my granduncle, Sir Narsingh Benegal Rao, was the author of the India Act of 1935, which was the basis for the India's constitution with the Indian National Congress. We have sitting next to me, Boli Madappa from Coorg, India, a coffee-growing area. She has worked in IT and telecommunications globally for over 30 years. She has negotiated the first private investment for broadband in India and is currently the managing director for her MACE consulting group and works between India and the U.S. Next, we have Heather Callender-Potters, who works in India through a company called PharmaJet, which is a needle-free injection technology focused on vaccines and public health issues and has global activities in other countries as well. And at the end, we have Rahul Parson, an assistant professor of Hindi and Urdu literature and culture here at CU and teaches South Asian studies courses. He's originally from Calcutta, India, and did his PhD in Hindi literature from Berkeley. And his interest is in Hindi women's writings and early modern Jain literature. So welcome, panel. Why don't we go down the line and start with Boli and ask just anything else you'd like the audience to know about you and speak to the topic.
Okay. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure being here. Can you hear me? I guess you can, huh? A little closer to the mic. I've been coming to CWA for a long time, always in the audience, so this is quite an experience to be talking about the country I come from, where I grew up. And I'd like to give you a little bit of perspective of my own involvement there, because I've spent a lot of time actually doing business there and understand the business climate and the cultural climate between the two countries quite well. I spent time in Boulder and in Bangalore, India, which is where I grew up. I come from a wonderful area in India called Coorg, which is the only coffee-growing area in India. I understand there's someone in the audience here who's actually from Coorg, which is quite unusual because most people don't know where it is. So thank you again. I just want to start out by giving you a little overview, since I'm the first one on, of where India's come since independence. Today, it's a country of 1.3 billion people, which is its biggest challenge. It's come far on many fronts, but it is doing close to nothing about its population, which continues to grow every year. There are roughly about 1 million people a month coming online in search of jobs, just to give you a perspective. So the issue with the 1.3 billion people, despite India's economic growth, is that 300 million of them still live below the poverty line on $1.25 a day, and 500 million of them are actually under the age of 35. Now, that's a plus and a minus. It's a plus because it's been written up a lot in the last few years as being India's demographic dividend. Because unlike China and its one-child policy, India has a whole bunch of young people waiting to come online to work. The issues are that we have, of course, are skill training and other things. So I'll get into that a little later. So I actually went back to India when it opened up in 1991, and so have some personal experiences of how the opening up of the economy in 91 has helped people, and some of the issues that it's caused in terms of development across the nation as opposed to in certain states. We'll talk about that a little later. Today, India has done a lot since communications opened up. It's got 462 million internet users, right behind China. And it has about, I think, almost a billion mobile phones. So with that, let me go on to tell you what the three stages of that I have, as I've seen them, of the development of India. So between 1947, when India got its independence on the 15th of August, through about 1975-77, and a little beyond, it was a socialistic, mixed economy country. So a lot of the businesses were controlled by the government. They were targeted strategically by Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was our first prime minister. And the other parts of the industry that were let out to the private sector were controlled by something called the License Raj. So there were five or six companies and people, very similar to the Korean chaebols, that actually controlled everything from, you know, food to airplanes. That was one of the key definers of that era. A second thing that was important was when Nehru came on board, he tried to keep India as a secular country. And when the constitution was written in 1950, it really talked a lot about, it was a beautifully written constitution, and talked a lot about equality and justice for all. Some of that may be coming up in question with the current government, but that's how it was in those eras. In 1972, Indira Gandhi, who was our third prime minister and Nehru's daughter, created a state of emergency in the country where, for the first and only time, the press was not allowed to operate freely. People were sent to jail, and there was a lot of resistance from the public. So that lasted between 72 and 75. In 1977, she was basically voted out of office, and they went back to a gentleman called Mr. Morarji Desai as the prime minister. Between 1997 and 1991, India continued to mull along with what they call the Hindu rate of growth, very slow growth. Nobody could come into the country and give people the most competitive products. One of the examples of the license Raj, for many of you who may have been in India, would be what we call a tuk-tuk or an auto rickshaw, three-wheeler. It was run by a man called Rahul Bajaj, who was actually a Harvard grad, went back to India, started this business. But he refused to bring a non-polluting vehicle into the country because he owned a monopoly on the polluting vehicle. So that lasted till India opened up in 1991, when it opened up to foreign competition, and then other people could come and the climate in India changed. So in 91, India had a crisis. It basically had a default on its balance of payments. And so Manmohan Singh, who happened to be the finance minister at that time, he later on became one of our prime ministers, actually decided this was the time now, instead of defaulting, for India to open up to private investment for all sectors. So that's when I went to India in 1991 with a company I work for here called US West, and we put in a proposal for $1 billion to open up the telecommunications infrastructure with wireless in India. It was a fascinating time because there were close to no regulations and rules in this particular industry, and so the seven years I spent in Delhi as the managing director, five of them were trying to draft a regulation to define how this needed to be done. I personally have experienced in the era between 1991 and now, in less than a generation, what the opening up of the markets have done for the people. People who, for generations, had lived in villages or had lived with no expectation of what they could do with their lives, tied into their karma, basically, were now able to actually go and work in the IT industry, which was in one of India's success stories, were actually able to get a passport and travel abroad if they wanted to. Most of their children go to private English-speaking schools. Many of them went on to college. They all work now, not all, but many of them work for companies like Hewlett-Packard and Amazon and AT&T. And this is all in a generation. So while they haven't really garnered the kind of wealth that you maybe have in America, what they have is now an opportunity, and they're not turning back. This is a huge plus for India, but it's actually also one of the big challenges because that has actually only affected a very small part of the population. So this 500 million that I talked about, with the 300 million inclusive there, which is under the poverty line, all now have these same aspirations. They have now, they are currently of the belief that they can do anything. They can go to school and get a job. And that's going to be India's biggest challenge because it's got very serious issues, which I'll talk about later, in education, et cetera. How am I doing on time?
Fine.
Okay.
Excellent. Keep going.
Okay. So So then I want to just go on and talk a little bit about what some of the successes are in India and in this period. One of the big successes, as I mentioned, is communications. India has developed a $20 smartphone, and while computers haven't been able, people can't afford computers, they now can access the internet in the depths of India's rural areas through a $20 smartphone that was developed in country. So it's got, as I mentioned earlier, almost a billion mobile phones, of which 50% are smartphones. And that's how people access the internet. It's in several Indian languages. Even though people can't read and write, they now are also using a lot of Siri kind of technology. So people can talk and ask things like the price of fish in the market before the fisherman goes and gets his fish, or you know how is wheat selling in Delhi from a rural area, things like that. It's been a phenomenal change for the whole country. Some of the other successes, I think that India, as a result of its non-alignment in the old days and then coming up as an economic power, is now taken very seriously on the international stage. It's taken seriously for two reasons. It's got a huge market, so most companies do want to have a presence there. And secondly, it stands between Pakistan and China and therefore is very strategic in terms of its value to both Western Europe and to America. So President Obama went and visited India a few years ago, he actually made a recommendation that they are part of the Security Council of the United Nations, and they need a seat at the table because of the power they now wield in the region, which is going to be significant. Of course, that hasn't happened as yet, but it's something that, you know, that's happened because of this opening up and where India stands on the world stage. The other thing that I'd like to talk a little bit about is that it is the largest democracy in India, and it remains, and it is one of its strengths, it remains a free democracy, where every 5 years we have free open elections. The last election was in 2014, and I believe there were almost 890 million people that voted. 890 million people. The next election is in 2019. It's quite remarkable. But everybody does believe that they participate in the society, in the democracy. It also has a huge free press, and in many vernacular and local languages, so people do actually read more than they read, especially here. All right. And several other countries do. Okay, so those are some of the challenges that I want to talk about, and I want to go back to the point I made earlier. It's 1.3 billion people, 300 million below the poverty line, 500 million under the age of 35. So while India has one big challenge, is one of my passions right now. I work on a not-for-profit board here in Colorado, a global education fund, which provides education to marginalized children in India and several other countries. But we don't provide funding for access, but for content. Because the problem with India, it has the right to education bill that says everybody has the right to go to school, but nobody is learning anything. So a large majority of these 500 million people who now have the aspiration that they can be anybody and in, you know, in a generation and a half or two, basically are graduating from high school, many of them going to college with no skills whatsoever. It's rote education. People pass exams, but they don't know how to function or do anything. India has failed in opening up at the number of vocational schools that it needs. So skills training is a big problem. So unemployment as a result of this issue is really high in India despite the opportunities. And the second reason it's high is because there's still 50% or more people who live in the rural areas, and that is not where many of these opportunities, they haven't actually permeated out there as yet. So that's one of the big challenges. Second one, which I think Heather will talk about, is healthcare. Very expensive, doesn't cover everybody, and there are myriad issues there, and I think you're going to address some of those. India has very serious infrastructure problems, which again is impeding in terms of its ability to compete. Its ports are abysmal. It's trying to build a road structure. But when I was growing up in Bangalore, I could drive my bicycle freehand down the streets. I can't drive anywhere near as fast. The streets, cities are clogged. Bangalore was built for 1 million people. It is the Silicon Valley of India. It now has 12 million people who live in it. It's close to impossible to move. And I'm sure many of you have read about the air pollution in Delhi, which is worse than Beijing. So the country hasn't addressed these very critical problems in terms of human well-being and health. You know, its literacy rate has gone up, but there are these fundamental issues with development that haven't been taken care of, and they need to be addressed for it to be able to sort out these problems. And then I would say the last problem is, it's the one I just talked about, which is the India stands 131 out of 188 on the UN Index of Human Development. And so you can never come out of being in a developing state till you get some of those problems fixed. So these are things that the country needs to address. My last issue I want to talk about is the current government that runs the country, which is the BJP. It is a Hindu right nationalist government for the best part. And while Nehru set up India, when he set it up, with a vision of it being secular, inequality, and justice for all, some of that is being eaten away right now with communalism, with gender issues. You've read about those in the newspaper for the last several years. And that could be a real serious balkanizing of India if it's not addressed. So I think that's something that needs to be addressed. India has 160 plus million Muslims. It's only 10 million less than Pakistan. And so this is, and they live all over India. So it's not that they're contained in one state. And so this has been a real serious problem that the National Party has not addressed and is actually causing problems around. And while I don't intend to be any way partisan between Congress and BJP, this is a very critical negative to getting the agenda done to bring prosperity to all of those people that don't have it, and therefore to keep India intact. Thank you.
Really good. And next we'll go to Heather, if you'd like to.
So is this on? If I were voting for someone to run India, I'd vote for Boley. In all seriousness, I bring a different perspective. I'm not Indian. It's really great that I have some experts here. But I was attracted to the first time to visit and travel to India in 1989. And I went with some fellow students. I was just finishing my graduate degree, and I have an international upbringing. So probably intellectually curious to start. But if you think about some of the frames of time that Boley named, we were at a relatively young age with no internet access and had the opportunity to meet with the Minister of Finance, et cetera, to see a different perspective of the development challenges of India at that time. And I think probably, in all honesty, I was way too young and naive to think that I could actually do something there. But it was one of those countries that in the back of my mind I thought that if they could solve certain problems, wouldn't it create a tremendous opportunity? So fast forward into my life and my career. I spent nearly 20 years investing money throughout Central and Eastern Europe, the CIS. I'm a fan of emerging markets. At the time that I landed was in 1991 when the wall had come down. So about 99% of the economies were related to the state-controlled sectors, which were in terrible shape. And I was part of an experiment with U.S. government money trying to invest in those countries to support what might be possible for private sector development. Even though that's not truly what happened in India, I think the same kind of transformation was kickstarted at about the same time. There's a huge movement in the world for change in many, many of these developing markets. And after a period of time of investing in these regions, I became entrepreneurial. So if you fast forward to what I do today and what brought me back to Colorado, where I'm originally from, I have a needle-free jet injection technology. So we focus on immunization for a reason. It's one of the largest, fastest-growing markets in perpetuity forever. So number of children born times the number of vaccines they get times the number of additional vaccine cures that we're developing over time. And India was the first market that we identified would be critical for our development. Part of the reason was birth cohort. Part of the reason was that at the time they were huge offenders of needle reuse. And the issue associated with a used needle is that either through needle stick or through reuse, there's that pass-along disease component. It spreads up to 20 bloodborne pathogens, most commonly hepatitis, HIV. And there was evidence at the time that in the garbage dumps, used needles were being cultivated, washed, repackaged, and you would never know that they'd been used. So this issue of disease burden for us was one that we wanted to address and cure. And the great news is that substantially, that's working out, not across the board. But if you look at the time that we've spent in India, perhaps the last 7 years, we now have regulatory clearance and we have a commercial development partner, which I'll talk about in a moment. The country has made strides, and yet it's more often than not in the private sector. So that middle class Indian market of roughly 300 million people pay for healthcare. What I observed in the emerging markets that I worked in initially is the same thing. The state system of healthcare was bankrupt. The physicians needed to open practices on the side in order to be able to support themselves. People needed to have solutions for healthcare if they had money. If it hurt or they killed or it killed someone, they were willing to pay for healthcare. I think the same kind of thing exists in India. And on the glass half full side, what that has brought is tremendous innovation and adoption, like a fast-forward adoption, a leapfrog of technology, and also creative approaches to lower-cost investment or more intuitive treatment of patients. There are examples. One, there's a very famous eye physician that has developed low-cost solution for things like cataract treatments, where there's an operating theater with 8 or 10 operating beds around a revolving group of healthcare providers. And there are robotics involved, and you can go and receive an operation that costs probably 10% of what it would cost here. And those kinds of innovative solutions are being duplicated in other places. But it also is related to the fact that there wasn't enough money to do what we do here. And there wasn't, frankly, enough regulation to suppress development. So I think, again, on glass half full basis, there's a tremendous growth in innovation. Glass half empty, there's a huge growing market of people, births, as Bolli pointed out, not enough jobs probably to take care of all of those people. A number of people that would like to migrate from smaller villages to the big cities where there theoretically are more jobs, and that creates a tremendous drain on infrastructure. So coming back to again, some of our path of development, I'd like to use an example of our partner there, which is the Serum Institute of India. They're the world's largest vaccine manufacturer by volume. So 1 out of 2 children receive an immunization from the Serum Institute. And that vision started with the Poonawalla family, who are in Pune, India. I don't know if anybody's ever been to Pune. But the objective for this new graduate who went to Cambridge was to come home to his family business, and there was a typhoid outbreak. And because they owned horses, they took the serum from the horses and tried to create a vaccine. And they were successful, and they solved that issue. And if you look at the development of that business over the last 25 to 30 years, they've systematically grown to, again, be the largest, the lowest cost vaccine manufacturer. And they addressed the emerging markets when all the rest of the large pharma companies said, why in the world would we ever spend time on those countries if theoretically no one can afford what we're doing? And I'm a believer that there are cartels that are built to exploit market opportunities and profitability, and you look at public market activities, and that's kind of the plan, right? Make it bigger, better, faster, and price in tiered pricing in different places so that you can maximize your profitability. In this case, the Serum Institute's approach was, if we can make them in volumes, we can afford to distribute to the rest of the world, and we can afford to have a very large market share, which reinforces the fact that we can be a low-cost manufacturer with low-cost pricing. And they broke the cartel. And if you were to look at GSK's reports in the last couple of years, they tout how much money they're making from emerging markets in places like India. Sanofi owns a vaccine company in India today. So I I'd like to think that I was brilliant in looking back and saying, we should pay attention to India. As a company, we're not there yet. We're still a postage stamp. But we have one of the largest, most incredibly ethical partners that there is. And it took us 4 years to get through India. So thinking about why it is that the cost of healthcare is what it is, we had to actually try three times. There's a tremendous amount of bureaucracy. But we became embroiled in the changes in legislation that were meant to protect Indian local people because there were some bad actors that theoretically were kind of using the Indian population as an experimental base for their developments. Now that we're out of the gate and we're commercializing, we're very optimistic that by creating that funnel, what it does for us as a foreign business, and keep in mind we're still a bit of a postage stamp, we now have three other Indian partners. So that one investment by our partner and by ourselves, including also the Gates Foundation, who helped subsidize these studies, has now opened up avenues with three other vaccine companies. And when we become a method of administration on the labels, what that does is it opens up our market opportunity to be able to go everywhere else in the world that those vaccines are produced. So by taking a step, a leap of faith, and saying we should invest our time and effort in India, we've created a solution that not only provides for clean immunization, so no needle, no needle stick, no pass-along disease, and your son or daughter or your granddaughter might not have hepatitis, all the way through to a shining example of what some of the largest countries and companies in India have done, where they are on the global map. Social responsibility is in place, large markets, large export opportunities, and I'm thrilled to be able to play a little bit of a role in that. And I continue to be an optimist. I know there are tremendous issues at the public health level. India is the largest country with the lowest budget for public expenditure on immunization. And immunization is the cheapest form of preventative health besides clean water. So what's wrong with that? Well, it goes back to budgets. But I am optimistic in that if some of these issues can be addressed and fixed and they're incremental, it will build a base that continues to be a shining example of what an entrepreneurial open democracy can create. And the limitations are indeed infrastructure and time, but I believe that it will continue to play a key role and an increasingly important role in the global development of technology and a tremendous opportunity for also domestic trading activity of Indian company to Indian company. So I'll stop there and continue on with the rest of the panel.
Thank you, Rahul. Go ahead.
Thank you, Nikhil. Thank you, Boldy and Heather. It's very difficult to follow these great discussions that you guys have begun, and I suspect there are many in the audience more qualified to sit up here than I am. But just a word about myself. I teach here at CU South Asian Studies, and my focus, as Nikhil said, is modern Hindi literature, particularly women's writing, and also early modern Jain literature. So this is, in a sense, how I really came to understanding India as I do currently. I was born in Calcutta, but my family moved when I was about four, so I didn't exactly grow up in India, but we went back a lot. And in grad school, I spent about 3 years in India. And I feel, I mean, I should say right away, it's kind of important to be in India to see what's going on. It's not always possible to follow from this distance. The panelists have presented a very nice image of some of the potential of India and what has been called India shining, and also some of the challenges, of course, too. So I will try to keep the same balance, but as my students will corroborate, I can be a bit of a killjoy. and I may lean a little bit, put a little more emphasis on some of the challenges India faces. In January, I was in a conference in Kolkata on the status of Hindi internationally. And so there were speakers from the US, myself, and from Mauritius and Fiji. and other places where Hindi has a life of its own and is very much informed by what's going on in India. And what struck me was after every speech, and I'm not exaggerating, every speech, the speakers raised nationalist slogans, Vande Mataram, Jai Hind, these types of things. And we had speakers from Bangladesh who are also interested in Hindi, and it seemed that there was a strong kind of nationalist emphasis being attached to language, to one of India's many languages. And so I sort of had to throw out my script and talk about nationalism there and here. And I want to start, by saying it's very nice how many people have come together to talk about India and think about India. And what also happens in our classrooms here and the university with regard to Hindi and Urdu, we forget that India isn't the only country that's turning 70, right? Pakistan has also turned 70, and we're less willing, in fact, to talk about Pakistan. And I'm not going to now, but in fact, I like to think about the region in my classrooms and not only the nation state, but that's a bit of a digression. I want to start actually with a quote from the first Prime Minister, Nehru, who at the moment before independence said, and many of you will know this quote, of course, "Long years ago we made a tryst with destiny. Now comes the time when we shall redeem our pledge, not wholly or in full measure, but very substantially." And it's that last part I found very honest and an earnest assessment from the first Prime Minister, this very substantially. And I think this is what we should consider. To what extent has India and the Indian state kept its pledge to the citizens of India, to the world community, and what are the challenges that remain? I don't find this type of honesty in many of our current politicians that would admit that there are still shortcomings. But Nehru was prepared to do that. I very much like this very substantially. So maybe we can think a little bit about to what extent this is true currently. India has undoubtedly achieved a great deal since independence. We have to remember that this is a post-colonial nation. When the British arrived, and I may get these statistics slightly wrong, I think India commanded something like 23% of the global GDP, and maybe 2 or 3% when the British left. This is, of course, shocking. So India was left impoverished. And 200 years or so of colonial rule had left India with basically no real industrial base, very poor agricultural sectors, and a vastly or quickly expanding population. But since that time, life expectancy has gone from 32 to 68, so more than doubled. The GDP has gone from, sorry, I have this in British pounds, 20 pounds to 5,500 pounds a year. Okay, so these are massive improvements, of course. At the time of independence, less than 1% of the villages were electrified, and now approximately 97% of the villages have electricity. Less than 12% had seen the inside of a classroom before independence, and now closer to 74% are literate, with Kerala reaching nearly 100% literacy. So these are some of the big achievements that a post-colonial state can manage to make. Every change of government in India has happened with the ballot box, with no military involved. This is a huge achievement. And at the time of independence, many Western thinkers, pundits, didn't think India was sustainable because of its diversity, because of the problems faced by India. And, of course, that has been proven wrong. India has maintained a more or less functioning democracy for this time. And I find when I'm in India speaking to all sorts of people, including rickshaw drivers, chai wale, and of course the sort of educated elite and people in my family, that there's a level of political consciousness that's very impressive. I believe people know their political interests quite well in India, sometimes I think more than here. I hope that doesn't sound offensive, but there are challenges, of course. It seems at this moment, as Boli referred to also, in the current political climate, India has started to turn its back in some ways on its promise of a tolerant and secular society. We still have these promises in the Constitution, as Boli said, a wonderful constitution, largely drafted by the law minister Ambedkar, the Dalit activist many of you will have heard of. I'll speak about him again in a moment. So who are these communities who are being left behind in some ways in shining India? Dalits, the former untouchables. There are still atrocities, also largely in rural India for Dalits. Of course, women. I'm sure many of you have heard about what has happened to women in the cities with gang rape and the difficulty of being out at night in certain parts of India. Adivasis are often forgotten. These are known also as tribals, so original inhabitants, Adivasis. These are the communities that live in the forests who have suffered first state policies to extract resources from their regions and now neoliberal policies to do the same. And so we have movements in these areas fighting back against this. You may have heard of these Naxalites and Maoist movements. And usually the media just wants to critique their methods, but we should really ask, why are they taking these methods? Why is this type of armed struggle against the state and against neoliberal sort of corporate greed happening? These don't happen in a vacuum. And so Adivasis, there are no Adivasi chief ministers. They don't actually exist in public life like they should. So the hopes for a participatory democracy fall short in this regard as well. The recent hostility towards Muslims and other minorities, particularly with these strategies of bans on cow slaughter and these lynchings of Muslims because of alleged beef eating. These are deeply troubling and worrying, and we shouldn't try to ignore these in a country like India that is capable of overcoming this type of intolerance and has made a promise to do so. We have to continue to insist that these things, this inclusion, the promise of the Constitution actually happens. I won't be a killjoy the entire time, I promise. So the political climate has also consolidated certain internal hunts for enemies within India, and this includes writers, liberal intellectuals, filmmakers who work with Pakistani actors. Many of you who have heard of this. An intensified support for the military occupation of Kashmir, regardless of how you feel about that, the brutality must be acknowledged. Okay. This comes from a country that before even independence, Pandit Nehru was opposed to doing business with apartheid South Africa, foregoing a lucrative trade deal in 1946. Think about how long it took this country to come to that realization. India was skeptical of making alliances either with the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, or the Western powers. Therefore, Nehru and Marshal Tito and others, Nasser in Egypt, I believe, formed a non-alliance treaty. So there's an immense amount of courage that came with the sort of beginning of the Indian state that we'd like to see sustained. But this majoritarianism, particularly as Boli mentioned, this right-wing Hindutva majoritarianism, threatens many of the other communities in India and represents a low road to electoral success, which we're familiar with here as well. Thanks for laughter. So So again, I wanted to reiterate that India had a very difficult start, an unproductive agricultural economy, a weak industrial base, and extremely low levels of literacy, 27% for men and 9% for women. And so huge strides have been made, and so huge potential is there. But with this growth, again, the complexities of what happens when we grow at this rate, the environmental disaster, I think Boli referred to this as well. It's difficult to breathe in Delhi, and the reason we know that is this affects all classes. But the environmental problems elsewhere in India can go overlooked. And there's a pernicious myth that a country can't grow without without destroying its own environment. And this has to be rejected. And this is where I think this is the most exciting aspect of current India, are the points of resistance and critique. Thinkers who came to our own campus here, like Vandana Shiva, many of you maybe saw her speak last year, who take a courageous stand against sort of received wisdoms about how agricultural should happen and how the environment should be sort of sold out in favor of rapid economic growth. Vandana Shiva, other thinkers like, I mentioned earlier, Ambedkar, the Dalit low-caste leader, who exhorted that the excess of democracy and justice in India required a call to the people to educate, to agitate, and to organize. Other thinkers, like Arundhati Roy, many of you know, courageously oppose the actions of her government, courageously visit these Naxalites and Maoists in the jungles, maybe if you've read these articles. Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, subaltern studies groups offer, these are scholars who offer a different look at history, and so the Indian model of seeing history from below, from the subaltern studies group, has informed global studies and global South studies across the world and inspired scholars to think about history in different ways, not just the histories of elites, but the histories of also peasant movements and sort of forgotten groups. And so these are very inspiring developments in India, the type of intellectual development and critique that Indian thinkers have offered. I mentioned Amartya Sen again. He has a book, maybe you're familiar with, The Argumentative Indian, in which he talks about the most ancient and persistent democratic institution in India is debate, that Indians are very happy to get together and argue. In Bengal, it's called Adda. Elsewhere, it may have a different name. Going back to the Buddhists, the early Buddhists, Jains, and Hindus who would gather together to debate, taking a few things as given and then debating on the nature of reality, the correct path to liberation, and so forth, but peacefully. And this institution, this idea of the argumentative Indian, which Amartya Sen says exists in every society but is highly visible in Indian society, is the type of sort of freedom of expression and thinking that India requires to come up with the best possible ideas to move forward. As I mentioned earlier, my main project is contemporary Hindi, but another interest close to my heart is early modern Jain literature. And there's a Jain philosophical idea called Anek Kantvad that I'll share with you. It is the doctrine of manifold perspectives. The ancient Jain philosophers realized that everybody has a real and legitimate claim to the truth, albeit partial, from that person's perspective. And this is how I think that India has been able to function and should continue to function, acknowledging the variety of perspectives and viewpoints that must come together to give a holistic picture of what the problems are and what the potential solutions are. So that again, is Anek Kantvad, if you want to look that up. And so I think we should continue to debate and argue, which I suppose we'll do now. And thank you for your attendance and your attention.
You mentioned 300 million poor at $1.25 a day. What is it today versus the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, et cetera? And what progress has been made since 1991 when India opened its markets to outside investment?
I'll take a shot at that. India opened up in 91. It only affected that many people. There's 250 million people who are currently in the middle class in India, considered the middle class. That's expected to double by 2020, by 2025, actually. There were 10 million people in the middle class in 1980. But through all of this progress, what the governments, various governments have done is that they've actually not addressed the issues of the people who live in poverty. While certain numbers have come out of that poverty, many of them remain there. So I don't actually know what the number is in 1947, when there were only 350 million people in India, but it's significant today. And I'm not sure you can address that better.
Can I see the question?
Yes.
Do you have something to add, Heather?
No.
If you'd like to address just improvement in poverty since in the past few decades in India.
I'm not qualified, actually, to address that. But I will say what I find so interesting in the English language representation of India shining is not the same story we see in the so-called vernacular languages, Hindi and Bangla and so forth. So there have been interesting critiques of the neoliberal reforms in literature. And I think one novel comes to mind, Kalikata Via Bypass. This is a novel about what it has meant, what the generational gap has seen in terms of changes regarding rapid development in India and who's been left behind. And so maybe to answer these questions more completely, we'd have to have a sense of how these developments have been seen from different perspectives, right? From what it has meant for farmers, for example. And would you like to add anything? Or?
I guess just to add a little bit that if we understand that rural India had no electricity, your statistic, and today rural India 97% coverage, I think that there is a building block factor here where we're seeing accelerated rates of development in a bigger economy. And that would certainly be true for my time in Central and Eastern Europe, where we took tremendous risk to invest in developing a mobile telephony network in Romania when there were orphans on the streets and wild dogs and people didn't have any heat. But the truth is adding connectivity and allowing people to communicate created tremendous wealth for that country. So I think there are certain things that today we would all agree are accelerators that make that GDP figure a little bit harder to interpret if you look so many years ago. And then lastly, there still probably continues to be a lot of barter exchange that's just not counted. Because when I arrived, for instance, again to Poland, the banking infrastructure didn't exist. It took 22 days to wire money. Companies paid payroll in cash. India has a tremendous banking sector, and then in the last, 18 months ago or so, they decided to swap out the currency. Hopefully everybody cashed in their mattress money. But these kinds of accelerators, I think, shouldn't be underestimated about what's going to happen with the acceleration of India's growth over the next kind of 3 to 5 years.
On a government building dedicated by Nehru in 1951, the sign reads, "Government is God's business." Under the BJP, PM Modi, is government still God's business? And this one is specifically asking for Boli, but again, all of you can take this one.
I'm going to let you address it first, and then I'll add to it.
Government is God's business.
It does say so on many government buildings.
Yeah. and then this addresses the current situation. I mean, this has a sort of frightening ring with this idea that that we're living in somehow in Ram Rajya, right? This moment in which finally, there's righteous rule, according to some perhaps more vehement supporters of the BJP. I'm not exactly sure if this question is asking if I believe this, or if we believe that this is somehow the reality of government work. Do you want to pick this up, Boli or Heather?
I'm going to address it slightly. It's not government work. It's not the reality of government work. But what is happening as a result of the BJP in certain parts of India, and I'll take the state just north of Delhi called Uttar Pradesh, where an actual God man was put in place as the chief minister of the state, who a completely radical Hindu national. So there have been some rather dramatic, there's been a lot of dramatic negative impact of his being there against the Muslims in that particular state especially. And so I would say there is a different interpretation. I myself don't understand why government buildings carry that sign of government business is God's business because of the way the Constitution was written and everything else that we talked about a little while ago. But it does exist. I've seen it on buildings. Mm. But it's been taken to a new level now with this current government, and not a good one.
Okay.
I hope that addresses the question wherever it came from.
I think it's a good answer.
Right. Well, somewhat continuing down those lines, it says, could you please comment on the Satya Sai Baba organization? He lived 60 miles north of Bangalore, and giving free education in all its schools and free health care in all its hospitals. So maybe on the role of addressing the population and health and education crises the panel discussed at the beginning, what is the role of say, religious affiliation in that and those kinds of charities in addressing those issues? And perhaps if you have comments on that.
I'll start a little bit. And again, because I'm not Indian, it's really difficult for me to pretend that I'm an expert. But I like to be able to draw analogies because I've seen enough of the country and had many, many Indian friends and traveled and lived all over the world. So if you think about people who are trying to change the paradigm, because that creates a different reality, tries to address a local problem. There have been very successful groups, look at Israel, right, that have communities that work together and have free education. I think that there are opportunities for those to exist in an isolated set of circumstances. I can't imagine that overnight that could become a universal norm. But what happens with respect to behavior is if there are successful examples, it changes sentiment. And you can't create a sentiment without change in behavior. So I don't want to comment on the merits of that particular location, because I'm certain that there are a lot of politics associated with it, but I am a fan of how much the paradigm's been able to change based on some of these examples.
So I've been to this facility outside Bangalore, the Sai Baba facility, and there are many, many others. Now, all of you know about all the gurus in India. There are many, many, many of them. So what these gurus have done, not just Sai Baba, is to their audience, the people who have given them all their wealth, and sometimes not so, they have created compounds within which they have free medical care. They have hospitals, free medical care, and free education. Now, you may recall that I said a couple of the issues that we have with India is that not everybody, education and healthcare don't reach the masses. So I think it's a perfectly legitimate role because at least these people have somewhere to go and get very good medical care. So, there's another one that you may have heard of, another person called Sri Ravi Ravi Shankar. He is he started out as an IT guru. And now he's accumulated, a gazillion billion dollars. And he's a huge campus outside Bangalore. And he has his own university, and he has his own school, and he has his own healthcare. So I think it's a way for them to try and give back. Is there an indoctrination process in play? I suspect so. But I think some bit of medical care is better than none. And most people don't have the ability to access it. So I think it's fine.
I agree with the panelists, especially your last point, Boli, that if there are no alternatives, so I'm not speaking directly to Sai Baba's compound, but generally, I just want to add, I think the danger, of course, is letting the government off the hook by handing over these services to generous philanthropists or what have you. It's while it's absolutely needed, but I also, as Heather said, this paradigm change where we see this kind of support for people and this open-endedness. I think we see examples in gurudwaras with these public kitchens where yes. people of all castes can eat. And so I think in this sense, in India, religion has played a very good example in some cases to push back against some of the strictures, but not in all cases. And again, I my central point is that we have to be careful if we start to rely on religious communities to manage the work of state, and then it maybe not won't be equally distributed or geographically distributed.
So I just want to add one point to that. The reality is that only 3.5% of Indians pay taxes. With great difficulty does the government get any kind of resources to spend on these gazillion needs that exist in the country. So I think that one of the things that the government has not addressed, while it gives like 4.8% of the budget every year to defense, is they have not found a way to address some of these institutions that need to be provided by the government. They've let the private sector come in, and I consider the gurus part of the private sector yeah. providing the services. I think it's going to be difficult for them because they just actually, in reality, don't have the resources to address it in a timely manner. Besides.
And a question that following along those lines, does continued state ownership of some industrial companies benefit the people of India in a way that private enterprise could not?
Could you repeat the question? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll start with that yeah. one. And again, drawing some analogies from seeing the transformation from virtually no private sector in Central and Eastern Europe, an 18-country block of activity to what it is today. And I think it takes a number of factors. So if you look at level of corruption, that plays a major role. If you look at size and critical aspects of functionality, you don't want to privatize certain things that people need to have as standard municipal services that might otherwise exploit the need to charge more for their services, which then has a negative effect on the local population being able to enjoy the basics so that they can focus on other things. So I think using analogies of a measured approach to privatization, you could use most certainly Central and Eastern Europe, where in many cases they've done that very successfully. They've also spun those things out so that they can be owned by a larger group rather than just, for instance, one. It also brings in foreign investment, which India desperately needs. And so I think an appropriate measured approach will be critical, but maintaining certain key assets for a good long time to make sure before those may be sold or privatized is important.
Excellent. Bully, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that's okay.
Next question is, how should the government address its pollution problem in India? Any thoughts? It's a small question. Rahul, you want to tackle it?
How to address the pollution problem? I'm the wrong person to ask. It's not my field, but I think I would just say what I'm taking this from the historian Ramchandra Guha, who says the first thing is to address the pernicious myth that we need to pollute to develop. And I think once we reject that as a myth, we can make progress in that we can find ways that innovate, maybe have slightly lower profits for a few people, but longevity for many more, right? So I'll stop there, but I think the rejecting the myth that we have to pollute. China and India have badly polluted their environments for a massive growth in their economies, of course, and I'd like to think that it could have happened maybe a little more slowly, but more sustainably.
Well, Well, I think China has addressed the problem now with green technology and most things, alternative energy. India's got has some stated goals that it wants to have electric cars for every car by 2022. Impossible, but there is a goal. And they are trying very hard now to use solar and wind off-grid, because there is no way to get the electric grid, even if they could and had the ability, to the whole country. So I think those are positive steps. They need to do more about urbanization, because one of the other things that has, you know, with pollution is that, you know, I said Bangalore was built for 1 million, 12 million live there. Delhi has 25 million people in that city today. And I would say it doubled in less than 6 years. That's not sustainable under any count. So that's, urbanization is a challenge.
And I'll add that I'm aware of a number of investors that are actually investing in alternative energy in India specifically for that reason. Right. So I think, despite that it's a domestic problem, it creates an opportunity for entrepreneurial activity, and they are approaching it in different ways, which includes farms of solar panels, because in certain rural areas that's certainly available, right? That the population concentration is not there. And then next, on a local per household basis, of things that actually started in Africa but have been combined together into one system, and low wattage LED lights. So I think there is going to be a little bit of a leapfrog again. If you look at the cellular technology, I'm certain that when Boley went in to start to develop those things, there was not a business case for enough money to have a self-sustaining cellular network that today you would look back and say, oh my gosh, right? A billion handsets. So I believe that there will be certain solutions that families must afford that will be made available that will increase their own personal wealth and the village wealth. And so if you look at it kind of like bookends, there certainly has to be some solutions that are larger scale as well as on a per household basis.
Actually, we based our business case on the fact that Indians love to talk.
And argue.
And argue. Yeah. But I think I agree with Heather here. I think there's lots of things that India is addressing by leapfrogging traditional technologies, and that this solution will come sooner than others to the country.
Yeah. And just one last anecdote. I think this several years ago, I noticed there was a full page advertisement with a picture of Manmohan Singh asking everyone to use solar water heaters. And I thought that type of engagement was amazing coming from here, because our leaders weren't taking full page advertisements asking us to make certain changes. So I think the changes, it's hopeful. I believe that things can happen in India rapidly, as I think mobile phone technology is an amazing example. While it was introduced, I remember I went there one summer and spent the summer, and a few people had cell phones. Seemed like the next year, almost everyone, and then the year after, everyone. So it took 3 years for things to kind of change. So I think India is capable of fairly rapid change.
I think there's a lot of hope on certain fronts, for sure. I mean, if you had seen Fareed Zakaria on CNN, maybe 3 weeks ago, he was talking about how, from a technology point of view, one investor, Reliance Communications, put $20 billion into a 4G network. And in 1 year, India has become the largest user of data in the world. Hmm. As an example, what they're capable of doing.
Excellent. The next question is, how has the media / press played a role in the development of democracy in India?
How has the media /
press?
Oh, okay. Yep. Well, again, I'll be the killjoy. I think lately the media has been kind of slavishly mouthing the interests of the ruling party in many cases. So the, not all media, of course, but we see a kind of restriction of speech in India with journalists and writers kind of threatened. Many of you have heard about writers returning their literary awards and so forth. So I think the media is robust in India and can really be a major part of the democracy, of course. And this may not exactly speak to the question, but another thing that struck me with the Indian newspapers, the good Indian newspapers, often have public intellectuals in the sort of editorials, I think much more than I see here. And the major Indian scholars are often speaking with the public about the current issues. And I find this really important, the engagement from historians and political scientists through the press. And so I think it's a critical part of the Indian democracy. Yeah. And we should be on guard when journalists have been silenced or even murdered in certain parts of India.
Yeah, it traditionally played a very, very strong role in democracy. When I lived in Delhi, I think there were 21 English language newspapers that were delivered to me. That was in the 90s, a long time ago. If you go to any airport in India, if you travel, you'll see that every newspaper is there for free, and everyone's sitting and reading a newspaper. So there, the debate is carried on, and that's why these people are in these papers, because people read, they learn, they do use. It has been a key part. It is, again, journalists are being affected by the BJP. Young Kannada, which is the local language in Bangalore, journalist, was shot outside her house by two BJP thugs. I mean, it's a proven case that just happened 6 months ago. This never happened in the old India. So they've been threatened because of the role that they played and how robust the media is in India.
Excellent. And beyond Free Press, could you speak to any platforms for citizen engagement with the legislative process in India? So the question is about civic engagement of citizens being critical to democracy. And so what does that look like in India today?
So I'll just, while you're thinking about that, there is a very robust, there are several robust platforms for citizens to engage. Two of them I'll mention. One is the Freedom of Information Act, where by law it was passed that if you had a question on any issue, why something was being built somewhere, why something was happening, you, in 30 days, the Supreme Court had mandated that they had to respond to the citizen and tell them exactly what was happening through the Freedom of Information Act. Land is a highly corrupt area in India, and in order to clean it up, basically all land records are now all computerized, not in all the states, but in most of the states, and you can query via the internet any question you want. And again, I think it's like 2 weeks for a response, and you can go to court. I mean, you can actually file a case if you don't get a response. So those are just two quick examples.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And just more locally in Calcutta, my aunts are involved in organizations for women's empowerment. And I find this really interesting how engaged they are. And in some cases, their husbands aren't really aware that they're out in the world and doing these things, publishing. My aunts often translate between Hindi and Bengali and English to sort of make the community aware of, their rights and how they can petition the government for certain things, particularly offering legal counsel to women in custody cases or in cases of violence. So you see a lot of these small civic engagement organizations, and I can only really speak of Calcutta in this case, but it's vibrant, and I think that's an important part of pushing back against some of the programs the government is either falling short in and so forth. There was an important book written many years ago called Fields of Protest, in which the West Bengal case, the CPIM, had a sort of women's organization branch. That's the former ruling party. That did nothing. But it was kind of just a symbolic branch of the CPIM. And this kind of undermined the women's rights agitations that were going on, because the CPIM could say, we already have a branch. But slowly, sort of independent branches opened, not branches, but independent organizations that opened that started to really challenge the CPIM, that it doesn't really matter which party it is, but challenging the ruling party in terms of what are you delivering in terms of protections for women and women's rights and so forth. And in this case, and so my aunts, I speak to two of my aunts, joined these organizations in order to engage with the government. And this, they are, part of, I think, a much broader network in Calcutta, and I assume many cities have this.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that needs to be mentioned. India has a very robust non-governmental organization sector, wherever you go. And these are people like his aunts who actually take up issues on behalf of the citizens of that area. And they've taken the government all the way to the Supreme Court on many issues. They've stopped dams being built. They've stopped also very, very effective in India.
Excellent. And I'll address this question to Heather and then open it up to the panel. How do you propose to solve or deal with the huge and growing population of India?
Just a small single-handedly, one. Right?
It's up to you.
Some friends will be helpful. Population growth is a tough one. It's possible to look at the difference between China and India in the last two decades of development and determine maybe what would have been best practice. I think in terms of healthcare and the population needs in India, the economy is actually open to help, and I don't see that in China. In my business, we have activities all over the world. Again, I call it my grand plan of global domination. We're not there yet. We're not replacing needles everywhere in the world. But if you look at the two different approaches to healthcare, India has had its act together from the point of view of innovation and quality for a very, very, very long time. And China has been systematic in creation of an industry that is insular and violates intellectual property. So I hope that the blueprint that India has created is better. I think one of the problems is that you have population growing at a rate that is just unsustainable in terms of providing a safety net for everyone. So without the proper implementation of a tax base, which goes back to government, it is not possible to provide a more universal healthcare system anytime soon in India. And yet on the other side, if you look at a controlled economy like China, you get the basics, but most people still pay for more. So I don't think there's a healthcare system in this world that's perfect unless they started a really long time ago. Perhaps the Netherlands would be a great idea, where if you go off and you spend 12 years becoming a doctor, this is, you know, college and postgraduate, and then somebody tells you that you're only allowed to work for 8 hours and charge X, and if you see more patients, we're going to fine you. I don't think there is a fix here, because in order to fix what we have today, we would have had to start a long, long time ago. So I'm not optimistic that everyone can have the same access.
Let me just give one quick comment to that. The bad news is the base. It's 1.3 billion people. The good news is that actually literacy, which has improved phenomenally in many, many states, has brought down the number of children people have. In 1947, the average number of children a family had was 6. Now it's 2.5 or something. I mean, it's 2 point something. I don't know the exact number. And that is correlated by state to the literacy level in the state. So education, one more time, plays a very key role, could play a very key role in bringing some degree of management around the population, but you still have, starting with a large base.
Excellent. And last question. We've got a little less than 5 minutes, but it's just a small one. If the panel would like to comment on this status today of relations between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. You each have 1 minute.
We have a deep relationship with a person in Pakistan. He's a Forbes 50 individual, and funny enough, family came from India. He and his daughter have a number of successful businesses that they've developed cross-border. And I'd like to think that there is a population that is educated enough to understand that they need to rise above the politics, and they would be a shining example. If you look the other way around, we have very significant Indian partners, and they would be more than happy to do business in Pakistan. But the difficulty, of course, is that you can't have kind of a direct relationship all of the time. That is something that is that it, once it becomes on the radar screen, I think becomes controversial with the population that is less educated and more emotional about the difference between the two countries.
Go ahead.
These are such excellent questions. They're very hard questions, and I think those are the ones to ask, of course. For this, I'm only going to tell a small personal anecdote. In October, I went to a conference in Islamabad to give a paper on Hindi literature, and it was a literature conference. And it was very difficult to get a visa because my passport, of course, says that I'm born in India. And so it was hard to go. And I was lucky to be invited, and I finally got the visa and went. And it was the hospitality and the friendliness was truly moving. I'm not exaggerating, and when I say I almost tear up when I think about this, because I was a little nervous to go and to see if being Indian in some measure would be a problem for anyone there. It was quite the opposite. And of course, I was with a university crowd mostly, but I also wandered around the bazaar and spoke to people. And mostly it was an intense curiosity about India and about what's going on over there. People asked me questions like, what is bhakti? What is satyam, shivam, sundaram? They would ask me these questions and I would answer it. You know, the internet might be more reliable in answer than me, but they wanted to speak to someone who had spent a lot of time in India and could tell them something. And many people, of course, as you said, have ancestors who had lived on the other side of the border. And most of the people I spoke to very candidly told me when I was alone with them that they wish partition had never happened. I don't think this is something you can say openly in Pakistan, but it's something pretty much everybody says. And so the public sort of hostility and saber rattling between the governments is not really what you see on the from the people you speak to. And I'll just give you a small example of the hospitality. I wanted to see Taxila, you know, the ancient sort of university or Buddhist center. Sorry?
Taxila,
exactly. And my hosts were nervous about me going alone. And so six or seven literature professors canceled all the classes for the day. I think the students probably don't mind, but I don't think I could pull this off. And the entire department and I, we went to Taxila and wandered around and talked about the statues of the Buddha and the various Buddha stories that were depicted there. And it was very moving that they took the day off to spend this time with me. And then we kind of looked around a sort of shared history of the region. I think it's a complicated question, but I only offer that personal anecdote because going to Pakistan really helped me see that there's scope for understanding, of course, between these countries.
Okay, I'll keep my comments very short. I think like in most places, governments get in the way of people. The people of the two countries basically have the same DNA. Manmohan Singh, our prime minister, was born in Islamabad, and Musharraf, Pakistan's prime minister at one point, was born in Delhi. It just happened, this happened during the partition. So I don't think the people are... I mean, there should be a way for the people to get together, and I think it would benefit both countries to get together. The issue really is Kashmir, which is very difficult to resolve, and that's where the greatest amount of tension is. But that's another whole debate, so I just want to mention that. That's kind of where things are at.
Excellent. And those will be closing thoughts. This last one just says, please mention the Jaipur Literature Festival in Boulder in September. That's all the time we have. Boli Madappa, Heather Kalanru-Potters, Rahul Parson, and I'm Nikhil Mankekar. Thank you all for coming out.